Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 123 with Steve Werner on where have all the $50,000 fix and flip deals gone? Former commodities trader turned hard money lender and flipper here in Chicago, Steve has a unique perspective on the real estate market and a bulletproof approach to mitigating risk when flipping houses. Competition is tight as we record this in November 2018, but there is still huge opportunity to flip houses, but you better select the right neighborhoods. They've always said location, 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 but the thing about this kind of market that we're in now is that the best locations, if you were to choose that location based on maybe the house where you'd like to live, may also be the riskiest locations to invest with pricing being as high as they are right now. But the good news is there are pockets in many cities where the prices have risen and risen quite quickly over the last 18 to 24 months that allow smart investors who've identified these little pocket opportunities to continue riding those pockets of appreciation while many other neighborhoods, typically the more popular flipping and fixing neighborhoods, have actually started to deflate in some markets. Steve and I are going to get into the details about this here, as well as that mentioned bulletproof method of securing your rehabs while fixing and flipping to pretty much eliminate the risk, or certainly minimize the risk of any vandalism of your properties. So let's jump right in, shall we? Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Steve, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Cool. So you just got back in from Philadelphia. We're both in different places here in Chicago recording, just so everybody can get a little bit of a background on who we are, who you are specifically. Maybe you could talk about sort of like the Reader's Digest version of your history, what you did before you're doing what you do now, and then what your business looks like today. And of course, this is real estate investor audience, so your business is not necessarily real estate investing. But it is very pertinent to our audience. So with that in mind, can you answer that long-winded question, Steve?
I can, and that was not long-winded. That was great. So my background is over the last 35 years, I was actually, when I graduated from school, from Arizona State in 1982, I went right down to the Chicago Board of Trade and became a 30-year bond trader in the biggest, craziest commodity trading pit in the world for 20 years. And then young guys like you and your technology took over my world around the year 2000. And I wound up getting into the hard money lending business. I was one of the first private lenders lending money to rehabbers and small developers in the city of Chicago. And I got into that because my brother and I were actually rehabbing properties and we couldn't get banks to understand how to lend quick enough to us. So we figured if we had that issue, many people must have it. So we opened up our own private bank for rehabbers, grew that until 2009. And then a cousin through marriage and a few other fellows came to me and asked me if I was familiar with this business of securing vacant and abandoned real estate with steel as opposed to wood board up. And I told them that I was familiar with one other company that was doing this on a grand scale. And it was my belief that they probably had a monopoly on the industry because I was using them. All the rehabbers that I was lending to were using them and I had never seen anybody else. And they confirmed that and told me that they were going to break that monopoly and asked me if I had a desire to join forces with them and open up my Rolodex and have them use their technology backgrounds to create a really efficient business. And we did that in 2009 and have now been at it for 9 years, pretty successfully in about 13 different cities now.
Nice. I think it's important. Why don't you list those cities off, and then we're going to talk about some of the framework of why this stuff is important to the fix and flip and even the rent, you know, the rental and landlord types that are listening to the show. So what are the 13 cities you guys are in, Steve, just so people.
Yeah. So give or take a few, certainly Chicago, which was our home base. And then we immediately went to Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, Columbus, Akron, pretty much all of Ohio, and then migrated east to New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, D.C. Newark is a big city for us. We've even tapped into parts of Virginia, Indianapolis, St. Louis. I think that pretty much covers it.
Nice.
Pretty much the entire Midwest and Northeast.
And there are other companies in other cities similar with the product that you guys have, which is like a steel bolted up security window and door system, right? So that if anyone's listening, they can still get value out of what we talk about today, even if you're not quite in their market, right, Steve?
Yes. Yeah. And there's one other sizable competitor. There's a lot of small folks trying to do this, but because it's a very capital intensive business, it's not a lot of people have been successful in accomplishing what we have. So, we're the name now in this industry, Dogs Door and Window Guard Systems.
All right, cool. So let's talk about kind of the background of the opportunity. So, 2009, 2010, 2011, 12, certainly in Chicago and Philadelphia, where we'll kind of focus a little bit of our conversation, because and many of the audience members are also going to be familiar with both of those markets. But we saw recovery taking place, Steve, and we would see fix and flip investors being able to find properties on the MLS, buy them, turn them around, renovate them, sell them, make anywhere from, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, enough profit to justify doing it, and then reselling it in like better areas with better school districts. Now we're in 2017, 2018, certainly for the last few years, maybe even last 4 or 5 years after we've seen the recovery take hold and the real estate prices stabilize. I know many of the listeners are nodding their head in agreement with you just can't really find quite as many of these, barely enough of them. Everybody's crying there's not enough deals. And when they're saying that, they're talking about these neighborhoods with the nicer school districts, you know, lower inventory, lower days on market. And along with all those things is lower crime rates, lower risk of break-in, lower risk of people stealing pipes, stealing building materials off the job when they see the vacant property. So it was you a few years ago. I got to Chicago. I didn't really know the market. We were having lunch together, and you started talking about the higher potential for profit in some riskier areas. Could you maybe just talk a little more on that subject right now?
Yeah, certainly. And you are right. I remember that conversation perfectly. And what I was specifically alluding to that day was that in some of the more distressed areas, the scarcity of inventory was nowhere near what it was in the better areas, and the margins were just much deeper. You were able to buy at much lower prices. Inventory had been sitting on the market for a long time for, you know, reasons, because some of these areas were highly distressed. They didn't have the school districts that were desirable that you spoke of, the parks and all the good things. But the irony is that the rents were the same as you were getting in the good areas. So when you did the math, creating an investment, the return on investment and the profit margins were through the roof compared to the more desirable areas. So we believe that our product actually created opportunity for investors to migrate into these areas and take a little bit greater risk, because we actually mitigated the risk for them. Their concerns always were for safety and of course, in terms of, you know, vandalism and break-ins. And they started noticing when they were using our products that, you know, the likelihood of that was dropping significantly. And we were even creating great efficiencies for them because, without getting long-winded here, previously contractors in those areas that were, you know, that were rehabbing in the, let's call it a little more dicey areas, would have to spend a good half hour in the morning, a half hour in the afternoon, removing their tools and other things that were inside the properties. And when we came in and started, you know, locking up these properties with steel, we were actually creating like a mini, you know, a mini vault or Fort Knox. So they actually felt very comfortable leaving their equipment and their tools in there. And, you know, you do the math, and not half hour in the morning, half hour in at night, that's, you know, 1 hour a day just moving tools around. Multiply that times a week, you know, you're saving 5-6 hours a week. And over a course of a month, you know, you're able to do really a few extra deals a year because of efficiency. So it was fascinating, you know, for us to see how more people started, you know, focusing on these markets right around that time.
So, you know, there's some other good things and some other risk mitigation I'm going to circle back around to in just a moment, sure. Steve, about, you know, going into areas you're not comfortable with. Before I do, I'm just going to briefly touch on how my view of the city of Philadelphia. I grew up outside of the city of Philadelphia, and I'm sure a lot of, you know, rehabbers and people get in real estate and they, you know, look to the larger city, and you look to the, you know, south side of Chicago, the West Philadelphias, and you're not comfortable with the area because you didn't grow up there, you didn't know it, so it just kind of seems like foreign, and it seems very scary and very risky, especially for, you know, the risk of break-ins. So I bought a property on the south side of Chicago about a year ago, almost to the day now, and I didn't do the walkthrough the morning of. It was like a pretty much move-in ready duplex and a two flat. And when I got there a week or two after I settled on it, the break-in might have happened the night before settlement. It might have happened, you know, a week before. I should have checked on it. Wish I did. But, you know, that is what everyone is totally in fear of, is coming back to the property, especially, thank God it wasn't after I renovated that property, but it was before we started doing anything in there. But you come in and, you know, the water's running in the basement. There's, you know, a kicked in window or a kicked in back or front door, maybe broken window on the side or the back of the property. And, you know, all the pipes are yanked out. The shower handles are yanked out. The, you know, the toilet's yanked out and smashed, and there's water running everywhere. And like, you know, all of a sudden it's an emergency to call the plumber, get the water shut off from the street, install a new valve if the, you know, if the, vandalism didn't damage the line too far into the wall where it's underneath the ground. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on of the things we fear. So we talk about, you know, mitigating that risk and creating kind of like a safe steel vault. And initially when I got in the business, I know a lot of people's solution, it still is my solution, to be honest, sometimes, Steve, depending on the neighborhood, I'm sending somebody by there to board up the property, and we're running nails or we're running in screws with special bits that can't be taken out with a regular screwdriver into the woodwork around the window. So if I'm a fix and flipper, I know that my attention to detail on a fix and flip property, to be able to turn that thing around, to sell it, to get through the inspection, I'm damaging my property by leaving these screws in there. Not only that, it kind of looks like an eyesore, these boards on the windows. And then when I take them off, I have, you know, a capping project at a minimum, if not a woodworking and repair project, where I got to do all my windows last and then touch up the inside. So the list goes on and on and on. And that was what I said to you when we met. It was like, well, you know, how does this product work specifically? So maybe you could describe or paint a verbal picture of like how this product is being installed, taken down, you know, to save me, the rehabber, the time of going back and doing all kinds of touch up and like half a rehab after you pull off these like steel boards and steel doors on the property when we're using, you know, the system we're talking about right now.
Yeah, you know, you hear steel and you know, you get nervous. And again, you know, it's such a great question from your point, like how does it affix to the building? And I think the unique thing is, you know, compared to the wood screws and stuff you were talking about that damage, you know, don't cause disruptive damage, but little damage that is time consuming and tedious. What we've invented and patented in 2009 was a steel panel that literally covers the outside of a window. It's got a brace built into it with threaded rods that feed inside the window. Like if a double hung window would be open, we feed threaded rods through inside the home, and then we have a bar that compresses against the inside wall. So it's almost like a toggle bolt, if you could, you know, picture that, right? It's so you walk up to the outside, all it is a piece of steel against the side of a building, and the reason it's secure is because there's a mounting system from the inside. And to alleviate any damage, we use rubber pads to go up against trim, drywall, anything like that, so that there's, you know, our product is never compromising the rehab work, the paint work, the windows, et cetera. And to my operations partner's credit, they developed an incredible system that they call Down Up. And what it does is, if a, you know, rehabber or flipper like yourself is putting in windows, trim, anything that, or need an appraisal, anything that requires those windows to be, you know, free from our equipment, we'll come down early in the morning on a given day, take off all the equipment, and then come back and resecure the property at 5 o'clock in the afternoon for a nominal fee, you know, because we understand that, you know, the work has to go on and has to get finished. And that feature there is super desirable from, you know, all the rehabbers that we work with. So I hope that answered your question.
It does. And that's exactly what, you know, looking for anyone listening to understand, that it's not damaging the property. It's not, you know, continuing to destroy and cause more problems later on down the line. So some of the.
Yeah. And by the way, Dan, our door works the exact same way. It temporarily replaces the permanent door, but it you know, compresses from the inside of the property. And the door has a mechanical locking mechanism built into it. So there's never missing keys or missing lock boxes. Only the property owner or manager gets the access code. So he can in turn give those out to different tradesmen and never have to worry about coming and meeting and handing off keys. And did this guy get a key? Did that guy get a key? What happened to the key? All of a sudden the guy shows up tomorrow morning on Saturday morning to, you know, do some painting or carpentry work and the key's not in the lockbox, or somebody forgot to put it back. It's that also has created wonderful efficiencies, you know, in terms of cutting down time on the projects.
Is that code easily changeable? Sometimes when my subs are done, I like to swap out the code just in case some helper that I didn't know or wasn't aware of, you know, kind of like mitigate that risk of somebody just stepping in through using the code. I mean, is that like an easily changeable thing for anybody, or can that be done during the process of the rehab?
That's a phone call away. It's a service call item, but, you know, we do that frequently. Yes, very frequently, because property owners don't want multiple people having the code for various reasons. So,
yeah, we've had that, you know, that was a process we put in place with lock boxes in general. It's like, okay, we're done, you know, getting this thing 100%. We've had properties, Steve, where someone moved in there over the weekend who had a lockbox from the real estate agent who inadvertently maybe gave it to them over the phone. And we come on a Sunday or Monday and someone pulled the scam and they're like living in the property in Florida. So, yeah, that amongst, you know.
We've seen that. Yep. No, and we also have a service that we call Doors Only. And that might be for, you know, a wholesaler that's moving multiple properties but has no intention of rehabbing those properties, but wants to make sure that access is always 100%, so that if a potential, you know, rehabber, developer, client has to drive an hour to come see that property tomorrow morning, he wants to make sure that he can get in that property, because that's a half a day sometimes driving out there, coming back. So there's never an issue with access. And a lot of our customers, you know, use our doors only when they're, you know, just for, you know, for accessibility purposes.
So when they put the door on in the wintertime, do I have to have a property that's winterized, Steve? Or is there still like the interior solid door somehow in there? Do you have to remove the existing door from the frame and then we're counting on only the metal door that you're installing there? And maybe there's weather stripping or something to keep kind of the elements and the cold weather out to some degree so I don't have frozen pipes and things like that.
Yeah, we have items that we, you know, put, we call them fins that, you know, secure any, you know, potential little air openings. But our steel panels that go over the windows do have perforated holes in them for lighting purposes and for air purposes. But we do have a winterizing system also where we come in and actually put like insulation, you know, a form of insulation in the window opening so that the property stays warm, you know, because we do get cold winters here in Chicago and in Philadelphia, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the contractors can't, you know, run drywall or, you know, the compound. They can't paint if it's too cold. They can't lay the tile floor if it's too cold. So there's, you know, times in the project we have to put the heat on that would definitely be an issue. So that's good to know.
Yep.
One of the things, so if we just back out a minute here on the opportunity again, because we talked a little bit there about the actual product, how it works, and some of the little details there. So we have a property. What's going on in a lot of areas is the prices have gone up so high, Steve, that in these better areas where it's not necessary to board up the window or create a vault for the tools to be in, the prices have gone up so high where you mentioned earlier in our episode here that the rent is about equal to the properties that we're flipping in a lower price neighborhood with a little more risk of vandalism and damage. So when I'm looking at that from the investor's perspective, I'm mitigating the risk of a flip as I'm getting into a market now, 2018. We're seeing some of the activity cool off in a lot of these markets around the country. I don't see it cooling off across the board when I look at a variety of, you know, markets throughout, you know, 5-6 counties in Chicago, 5-6 counties in Philadelphia. And just like you probably do, you're looking at all those counties and all the markets that you're in. There's some pockets that are worth, you know, continuing to invest, and there's some that maybe are a little shaky there where it's a higher risk of I buy this property in this better area, and by the time I flip it, you know, I don't know what it's going to look like in the spring of 2019. A few more interest rate hikes and the market cools off, and I don't know. It's possible I could see a 3 or 4% decrease in price because of the activity and the increase in mortgage payment that I'm seeing. Which would make this like this rehab in a nicer area, which was typically hotter, suddenly that becomes a little more risky than perhaps a property that I'm looking at in that lower priced area with the same rent, where if the market were to change like it did in 2008, where everything froze up and you're stuck holding the property, if I've got to turn around and rent out either the nice property in the nice area, or I got to rent out the nice property that's in the riskier area for the equal amount of rent, like which one's going to net me maybe some cash flow or at a minimum cover all of my holding costs for an indeterminable amount of time until the market's strong enough to actually sell that, make a profit or get out of that property. I mean, am I right in that assumption, Steve?
I think so. Yeah, you're 100% right in that assumption. And, yeah, I think the riskier neighborhood is going to yield a better return, you know, all the time. And I've been watching real estate prices since 2008, and in the harder hit, riskier areas, they have not even gotten back to, you know, to 50% of the crazy highs from the pre-bubble market. And I think that's a great sign because, rents versus, top end values are fantastic.
I've been watching the same areas, not quite since 2008, but some of the places here in Chicago, south suburbs of Chicago, you know, I've recently done a zip code by zip code study of every market that I'm in. And what I found is there's these little sleeper pockets. There's these areas where the intrinsic value of the house, what it would have cost to build new, you know, there's a lot of neighborhoods where you can buy a property, renovate it for less than it would cost to build new. That's like obvious. We get that. but it makes sense because it feels like some of those neighborhoods that you're talking about, the riskier areas, the more challenged areas that really got hit hard in the recession, that haven't come back quite all, you know, as rip-roaring past what realistic pricing should be. It's like they're closer to the intrinsic value now, and it's creating that opportunity where people who are looking for renovated product can still buy something that's renovated in an area that was maybe looked at as a little more risky. And maybe, to be quite honest, Steve, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, even 2 years ago, a lot of these neighborhoods hadn't appreciated to the point where you could get in and do a renovation, turn around and resell that renovation and make a profit. There really wasn't the upside of the retail values where they needed to be. And I'm starting to see some of those areas, especially in the Philadelphia market and especially in, you know, the south suburbs of Chicago here market, starting to see some of those like sleeper areas that no one would have looked at before starting to heat up, starting to be a place where you can make $40,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in profit, especially if you're able to kind of identify some of those areas that are starting to heat up and still ride the tailwind in a sense of the market where these are the only reasonably priced renovated properties that are available. And so we're seeing areas where year over year square footages have jumped 8, 10, 12, 14%. And it's starting to make more sense to flip in those areas, especially when I couple that with my lower risk if I do have to, you know, hang on to that and rent out this perfectly renovated property, which, to be honest, I feel like there's enough demand from you know, millennials, demographics, people in general who've been kind of saving up and buying still. There's still demand, but it's more like our real estate market has cooled off in a sense that the pricing is holding things down, not necessarily an oversupply of property like we saw in 2008.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll also tell you, you know, you specifically mentioned Chicago and Philadelphia, and they're just such great anchor cities. You know, they're cities that people want to live in or want to live near. So people are, you know, they're even willing, you know, a lot of folks that work in downtown Chicago are willing to move out, you know, 40, 45 miles out to the south suburb where these little pockets exist and, you know, become a first time home buyer because they've been a renter for, you know, the last 10 years. So I'm seeing the exact same thing, you know, just little pockets of opportunity where, you know, if you're doing your homework and you're in the game, you'll find inventory. If you're just one of those people that, you know, watch a lot of late night TV and think it's easy, you know, well, probably not, right? But if you're working, if you're, you know, like yourself, doing massive amounts of homework and, you know, understanding zip codes and, you know, desirability, you're going to find opportunities. That's for sure.
And I got to be honest, Steve, you know, I have the choice to flip properties in any area, and a lot of investors maybe do, right? And we choose certain areas, we're comfortable there, the deals come through there, it's sexy to get a deal in certain zip codes, certain area that's, you know, in the better school district. Those deals definitely come through, but when you reach a point where you have capital and you have resources to do some volume, and you're able to look at these areas like, the, you know, like on the south side, I feel like I'm doing good with my business. Not only am I setting out to make $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 and return on my capital and pay my private lenders their return and keep my contractors working. I'm like doing good for the economy and doing good for the neighborhood by choosing to go ahead and into some of these areas and invest and like participate in kind of like not necessarily gentrification, but like certainly some revitalization that has to take place in some of these areas. So it's kind of in a sense a way for me to like do good in addition to doing business with the profit mode, if that makes sense.
I get that inherently. I mean, I mentioned at the onset that I was in, you know, the private lending business, and, you know, we always took great pride in the fact that we supplied capital that went into impoverished neighborhoods, you know, helped rehabbers, helped corporate people transform themselves into entrepreneurs and rehabbers and create jobs for multiple trades who were buying goods and services from local establishments and then creating affordable housing. And you're doing the exact same thing, you know. So you're in business, you're making a profit, and you're doing a good thing for society all at the same time. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
So, Steve, I know this is a little off topic, but it just popped to my mind. Have you heard anything about the recently passed or being passed and implemented the Economic Opportunity Zone investment? That we're starting to see. Do you know anything about that by any chance?
I have heard rumble. I've heard that term mentioned. I can't tell you that I'm familiar with it, but I hear rumblings of it.
Yeah, so I recently heard rumblings. I saw something in the business journals are starting to talk about it. And, you know, my basic understanding of this and what I'm guessing is that this could potentially be a wave of appreciation, event in a lot of areas that typically did not get to see the economic recovery that a lot of the areas that are, well off, better off, did in the last 10 years. So, the opportunity zone, from what I understand, is an investor can sell an asset, and instead of having to pay capital gains, I believe it's a 10-year period, they can reinvest that entire sale proceed without having to pay capital gains. So a Facebook founder has a cost basis of like zero on their stock. They can sell $2 million worth of that stock, Steve, and not have to pay capital gains for 10 years on the gain. So it's almost $2 million in gain they would pay tax, as long as they invest that $2 million in whole into an economic opportunity zone, which it's up to the state governors to dictate where they're going to be. They're going to be, I believe, Englewood and the South Side here. There's a few of them in the Philadelphia market. They're all over in every state. All 50 states get to choose where these economic opportunity zones will be so they can invest in real estate. You're going to see a lot of large-scale institutional money coming in, and some very large developments are going to come in to start to do this. If a business were formed and the headquarters, like Facebook, for example, was formed in an economic opportunity zone, the entire gain on that investment, I believe, is also going to be free from capital gains. But 10 years in, whoever the investor was that makes that investment of the $2 million, if we're continuing the example, 10 years in, they would have to circle back around and pay the capital gains tax on that initial gain of the $2 million at whatever the long-term capital gains tax is at that time. So that's their risk. But if that $2 million were invested into a business or started up a business headquartered in an economic opportunity zone, potentially that could grow to, 4 million, 10 million, 100 million, or even, billions of dollars for the right person, well played, who establishes the next Facebook. And none of that gain would actually be taxed at the federal level. So this has the opportunity for people who maybe weren't looking at these other neighborhoods, even if it's rental properties in some of those areas. Like, there's potential for us at the single family residential real estate level to pay attention and select and get our tickets, our pieces here in some of these economic opportunity zones, and doing things like with the, with dogs on the windows and renovating the property and getting comfortable with some of the other risks that we have there. There's potential to see, some of the theories are going to see a lot of gentrification in neighborhoods that initially never saw it, as, hundreds of millions of dollars pour in from people looking to park money from all over the place in these opportunity zones.
Yeah, what a great opportunity to what a great insight, or, to have that information and be able to, plan a strategy to acquire properties in those zones. As an investor, and I've been a small investor in my career, I always liked investing around, hospitals or universities, because there was, always a large demand for rent, doctors, nurses, students, et cetera. And now this is kind of creating the same thing, as this money pours in and more jobs are created, more people are going to want to live closer to where they work, et cetera. And sounds like an amazing opportunity for what you're doing and the folks that you work with.
Yeah. And if anyone's listening, please don't hold me to the exact facts. I'm sure I butchered a few of them. We're going to get, I believe we're still waiting on the actual tax code to be handed down. Like, at any minute, it may have already been handed down by the IRS. It may be coming out at the beginning of the year. So I'm sure there's some holes in my knowledge. Please don't take what we said here. Take it with a grain of salt, but look into the opportunity.
Always do your homework, right, Dan?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's my disclaimer right there. I'm not an attorney. I'm not selling or giving investment advice. I'm sharing my perspective here and, you know, run with it. Hopefully we can all figure out a way to benefit from it. But cool, man. Steve, did I forget to ask any important questions about the product, the neighborhoods, anything that pops to mind that you think is important before we get to our wrap-up section here?
Yeah, one thing that I did fail to mention, and it's really important, is that dogs, our business is a full-service rental company, right? So we come in, we don't sell the steel panels and doors. We rent them. We come and install them. We come and take them down and and provide any service along the way that might be needed. So we are, you know, we have done our homework like everybody else for years, and we are pretty commensurate with board up. I think it's important to mention that. And certainly one break in of any kind, we prove to be much, much cheaper. So I would encourage people to look at us as not only an alternative, but the way to go in the more distressed neighborhoods for sure. And you're starting to see us, on the north side also, because as I mentioned, crime and vandalism, unfortunately, is not a hobby. It's a full-time industry in major cities. So.
Absolutely. Cool. So Steve, I have a question I ask of all my guests. I have found some fantastic books, but one or two books, could be real estate related, could be, something else, professional success, et cetera, that you have recommended most often to people looking to, improve.
Well, I'm sure you've heard this one 100 times, but, the ancient book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, it's one of it just never loses its zest, despite the fact that it's probably 80 years old, but it's a great mindset book for the thought process behind, how to establish wealth. And then without being too self-promoting, I wrote a book that's on Amazon called The Titan, and it's a business book about a guy that gets thrown back in time and discovers his business DNA. And I think that the lessons in my book, though very short, are imperative for anybody looking to go down the entrepreneurial path. And, it's called The Titan, T-I-T-A-N.
Nice. I'll check that out.
Yep. Thank you.
So, Steve, if you could go back and share, early on, 18, 20 years old, if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom for life, for business in general, what would that be?
Patience. Absolute patience. I came from I got put into a world of instant gratification being a commodity trader, which was very unrealistic, though I was there for 20 years. But I've learned now to don't second guess yourself all the time. Make good decisions. And sometimes good decisions don't work out the way that you wanted them to. And you can't go back and kick yourself in the butt, because at the time, if you did your work properly, it was a good decision. And variables change, right? Real estate markets happen, recessions come and go, and you can't predict that stuff. So stay true to your convictions, I would say, and learn to be patient, because with patience comes really good outcomes.
Nice. Steve, if anyone's listening wants to get some more information about you or dogs, do you want to share some contact info or a company URL?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Steve Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R. I'm the Director of Business Development at DOGS. And that's an acronym that stands for Door and Window Guard Systems. We could be found at our on the internet, which will give anybody a great idea of our products and services, our coverage zones, et cetera. We're at www.dawgsinc.com. So it's dogsinc.com. And I could be reached directly at area code 847-312-8777. 847-312-8777.
All right, cool. Steve, that brings us to the conclusion of our time here. I really appreciate you shutting the door, closing out the distractions, and sharing this this wealth of information here with our listeners. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show and giving me the ability to share with your listeners, and I greatly appreciate what you're doing, you know, for the real estate communities that you work in as well. You know, you're making a difference in multiple communities, so I applaud you for that.
Thanks, Steve. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. I am actually going to share me recently being interviewed by the world's longest-running daily podcast host, Joe Fairless, of the best-ever real estate investing podcast show. The topic, raising private money for single-family flips. I remember when I just got started investing and I didn't have the money to flip my first house, and when I discovered the power of private money, that is, getting money from a private individual to buy, fix, and sell a house with no credit check, no income verification, etc., I was blown away because I was starting from ground zero myself back in 2006. It really opened a door for me to get in the business and start fixing and flipping houses without having to spend maybe half a lifetime saving up for the cash myself to be able to invest in that first deal. The interview focuses on the important pieces of information you absolutely must know on both sides of the private money equation. That is the lender and the borrower. So if you're listening right now and either considering loaning money to an investor to flip a house or considering approaching someone you know to fund a house you're going to fix and flip, you'll definitely want to catch that episode. Now, are you interested in a pre-release of that next episode? That is, before the email goes out? When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email notification is sent out. And if you prefer the email, just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. I am always buying houses, so I am always looking for deals in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia specifically. So if you have a deal, preferably one that I can fix and flip, please send it over. You can either email me or contact me directly at reidiamonds.com. Also from that site, you can check out available profitable real estate deals and the entire archive of the REI Diamond Show, totaling more than 122 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. That concludes this one. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.